Welcome to New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, and I am so grateful to be here today with Kaylin Salmon. Kaylin and I met, I'm guessing, and maybe I'm being a little bit liberal here, 4 or 5 months ago. And it was basically around this idea of what you do as a passion, not as your full-time work. And that is providing housing, this is my words, providing housing, healing, and mentorship for returning citizens.
Said so well.
Did that come out okay?
That was great.
All right. His day job is being a successful entrepreneur. And I know there's several businesses.
Yep.
And I'm saying, you inspire not only at work, but then you also inspire within the ministry that you've started called Identity Ministry. So Kaylin, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no, love to be here, man. I'm really super nervous, but also unbelievably excited to be on a podcast. Like I told you just kind of before we started, this is my first ever medium for speaking in any kind of digital public. So I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah. And as we get into it, you'll understand a little bit more why that's a big deal.
Yes,
from his perspective. Here's what I will say before we get started. You're walking the walk and you're putting your time and capital in what you're called to do. And you are in the weeds. And we need more guys and gals like you doing what you do. So thank you before we get started. All right. So we'll see how deep you want to go here. So
okay.
Start off, and I'll probably interrupt you a little bit here, but where'd you grow up?
Okay. Where'd I grow up? Naugatuck, Connecticut. So a huge shout out to New Englanders. Naugatuck, Connecticut is a very small little town, kind of rural, you know, middle class, just south of Waterbury in Connecticut. So I grew up there, went to high school there, got arrested for my first time there, put a laxative in a teacher's water bottle. that was so far past the expiration date that they deemed it a poison. So I caught a attempted assault, breach of peace charge at 15, and they walked me out of my ROTC class in handcuffs. My mom came and picked me up. And so we made the decision pretty much then to go to military school because, you know, that's what parents did back then. So I graduated from New York Military Academy, same as Donald Trump, in 2003 as a second lieutenant.
Okay, well, you jumped right in there. So I got to go back to this first little offense. Was it funny to you or was it like, oh, this is real?
It was hysterical right up until the handcuffs came out. So we thought it was funny. She didn't actually drink the water, by the way, which is why I got attempted assault.
Okay.
So I guess I left the lid off the bottle and she figured it out. She was real sharp. And looking back, like a phenomenal teacher, I'm really kind of bummed we didn't have a better relationship, but I was a terrible person. So that happened. And then, yeah, they grabbed the handcuffs in the security office and they walked me out of the school into a police car. And I think the first time you get handcuffs put on you, you really have this kind of epiphany that, oh, holy crap, this is a real thing, not just something I see on TV. Right. And when that happens, that really shifts your perspective on the law and how things work and those kind of things. So then, you know, getting walked out to the police car, getting sat in the police car, getting booked, photographed, those kind of things as a high school student.
So you're how old?
15 at that time. Yeah, that just kind of, that made it real and really scary. Now, granted, you know, they called my mother. My mother was a very stern, a great lady, but a very stern woman. So she comes down and just whoops me on the way. I mean, all the way on the way home, on the stairs, getting to my room, you know what I mean? Like just didn't let up. And finally I make it to my room and kind of calm down. And there was just this peace that kind of sets over you when you're finally out of the fire for a minute, you know? But yeah, then I had to go to court 2 weeks later and go sit in front of a judge and get probation for a year, which juvenile probation, I didn't know what probation was. It was just, you got to go report to this guy once every month and do that 12 times and you're off probation.
Let's jump here and then we'll come back.
Sure.
And I'll spill the beans. You end up eventually spending some more time in later years.
Sure do.
So once you got reestablished after that, what did you do for a living and maybe what you're doing up to today?
So I started off selling cars and absolutely loved the car business, did really well in the car business. Then during that time, I caught my charge. After that, came back to cars for a short sabbatical of like 5-6 months, was back to a very unhealthy lifestyle. And during that time, got violated my probation. So I was sent back to Texas. Once I got done with that, I came up, did some odd jobs. I was like an assistant manager at Jimmy John's for two days. Did not want to be there. Ended up selling cell phones at a kiosk for AT&T for a very short time. Then I answered a Craigslist ad because I have this background, right? So nobody regular really wants to hire you. Mm-hmm. Car businesses, even though my resume was phenomenal, all of my, all the people that were going to vouch for me were phenomenal, my references. And just, they wouldn't take me because of this background. So anyway, I answered this Craigslist ad for a guy that has this mall kiosk. In the middle of Wichita, Kansas, in a mall. So I answer the ad. I start working for him. And his whole thing was, he's like, well, I just want to get my profitability, because he was negative at the time. I just want to get back to zero by the end of December. And if you can do that, we're good. I'll pay you a bonus. We'll part ways. And to do that he would take about $20,000 in gross sales in 2 months. Well, we ended up doing 60. Mm. So with that, I mean, obviously his mind changed, and well, now let's not close it. Let's build. And so over the next 3 years, we built several locations, had two traveling road teams doing home shows, state fairs, events, things like that all over the country. And I ran everything. So we built that into a $1 million business. Fast forward a little bit. I leave there. I start my own. Things happen. And now I'm still working with the same manufacturing company that made those first TENS units.
Okay.
Now I am a 20-year long-term consultant with them. And we've been crushing it. I designed my own piece of medical equipment. And so that's taken off. It's a piece of post-orthopedic surgery equipment called TruStim. And that's been doing really well. Same manufacturer, just new piece of equipment. So I found people that gave me a chance, and they were really loyal to me. So I've been really loyal to them. And we've made now, I mean, I don't even know where we're at gross wise, but it's we're doing exceptionally well.
That first experience you went, you know, the goal was, hey, raise $20,000 or sales, you end up getting 60. What's your giftedness? What's your secret? You've obviously have done phenomenal from a business perspective.
Sales, negotiating deals where everybody wins. That's the secret for me. It's the really interesting thing about being in the pain field is that if you have something that's legitimate and that works, it's always a win-win scenario every time you sell something, right? So if you come to me with back pain, how much is that back pain really worth?
Sure.
Right? How many nights are you up? Quantify it however you want, but there's always a quantifiable figure. So if I can sell you something to alleviate that pain, even 50%, what's it worth to you, right? But both of us are able to win. So I've simply done deals now my whole life where everybody wins. So we've owned a solar company, roofing company, custom stone business, all kinds of stuff. But the whole goal is that everybody has to win. Everybody has to get what they want. Otherwise, we don't do the deal.
So let's go back then, this middle section. Tell us your past.
Okay.
The good, the bad, and the ugly.
Woo. All right. So tell us a past. So I was married first. Got married at 18, went into the military because I'd flunked out of college because I was not by any means an academic. So flunk out of college, go into the Air Force, do what everybody tells you not to do, get married to the first really girl I saw there and thought I fell in love with. And we have this super horrible 3-year nightmare that is just, it's really just, for lack of a better term, a living hell, right? It's really bad. And there's infidelity on both sides. There's literal hate on both sides, just going back and forth. In the kind of middle of that, I end up having relations with somebody who's underage, right? So I was 19, she was 15. And so that happens, right?
Did you know she was underage?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I did. I didn't think about it at the time as criminal, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's not the, mm-hmm. Hey, this is a criminal act. I'm going to mm-hmm. do it anyway. That wasn't going through my head at the time. But it was, so mm-hmm. it doesn't matter what was going through my head. Mm-hmm. Go through that. We kind of have these bad things happen. I go to jail. I do 13 months, well, 9 months the first time, 7 months the second time. You know, it's a very interesting transition because you're marked for life, right? So even though I beat the charge, right? Which means I wasn't not found guilty, I signed a plea agreement that says that I would complete 6 years of probation, which I did. And at the end of that 6-year term, the conviction would be overturned, right? So you would not have to deal with this ever again. 6 years pass, which I know we're kind of going different angles here.
It's
but,
all right.
But yeah, 6 years pass and I complete the term. They overturn my convictions. I get my rights back, but they don't take me off the registry. They don't tell you that when you sign the plea agreement that you're on for life.
So let's stop here. Registry, for those who don't know. So you're not just at this point a felon.
Right.
You are actually a sex offender, or as the vernacular you used, an SO.
Yep. So you're on the registry for life. There's no way to get off. There's no hope to get off. So now you have to abide by all of these really wild rules and regulations and things. And yeah, so that's impacted me. I mean, it literally forced me, which I'm thankful for, but it forced me into entrepreneurship, because you can't get a high paying sales job. I mean, you know, what Fortune 500 company do you know that's going to hire a guy on the registry?
And you know, this may be the first time people are here. I mean, not hearing the term, but probably digging into it a little bit. So look, when I hear sex offender, it's this red light that goes off and yeah, everything under the sun in my head is thinking. Define for us a little bit about what a sex offender is, what it isn't. Help us put some context so that we're not all just thinking they're the worst of the worst in our head.
First of all, thank you for even asking the question, because what I'll tell you is that nobody wants to ask that question, right? And we'll explain more when we get into the ministry and things like that. I'm sure how that works out. But it is such a broad and wide range for what a sex offender is and is not. And it's not necessarily a bad thing that when you hear that word or that string of words that, you know, red alerts go off, because yeah, it is something you need to watch out for, but not in every case. There are a ton of sexual offenders on the registry right now that are nonviolent. Right? They were downloading images online, or, you know, somebody was peeing in public. That's a sex offender now. We've had somebody, not to give away, but we've had somebody come through the ministry where they were seen naked through their own front window in their bedroom by a car that just randomly pulled into their driveway, and they reported it to the police, and that man did 5 years.
Wow.
For exposition. So for unlawful exposing or something like that. I can't remember the name of the crime. But now, are there the people who are hanging out in pano vans hunting kids? Sure. But is it less than 1%? Absolutely. Right? Those people that you think of when you hear that word make up the drastic minority of all of the people on the registry. The hard part, I think, for the justice system right now is that they're trying to blanket that term. And now Florida and a couple others have done a really good job of trying to designate sexual offender versus sexual predator.
Okay.
But that still doesn't get to the heart of the matter, right? So even predators can, if you have offended twice, that can deem you as a predator. It doesn't mean that you're hunting kids,
mm-hmm,
right? So it's a really difficult thing to diagnose. What I'll say is that the crazy thing is that sexual offenders, if you take out the failure to registers and like their technicalities, they're the least likely to reoffend of almost any felony, right? And we saw that recent rubric come out where drug offenders, violent offenders, assaults, domestic violence, all those are more likely to reoffend than a sex offender. The other crazy thing about it, and this is pulling, and I'm sorry if I'm going long, but
no, you're good.
So this is pulling from a personal friend's story of mine. So he was actually a sheriff in Kansas. Now, this is the time where I live in Kansas and all that kind of stuff. So he's a sheriff in Kansas. I won't say his name because I don't want to put him out there. He was accused. So him and his ex were in a fight. His ex, and this is, by the way, verified from the victim. So his ex gets her daughter to make an accusation against my friend. Okay. He has mountains of forensic evidence proving that this is false. Absolutely mountains. The court deems all of the evidence unfit under the, it's like the victim shaming law, right? It's Megan's law. So you have to, so now he has all of this proof basically that he didn't do it, right? People that would testify on his behalf, all of these things. But because it would call into question the credibility and the mental stability of the victim, the supposed victim, you can't use any of it. Also, for those of us who don't know, any sex offense charge in the country as far as I know, it's in the country. I know it's in the state of Florida. It is the only set of laws that you are actually guilty until proven innocent. The burden of proof belongs to the defendant. not the prosecution. So you're literally stacked to lose. Now, I am not the guy who's going to sit up here and say, I was in the wrong. I did what I did, right? And I suffer with it every day. I have to live with that every day, right? There's no road back to admonition or you know, any freeing of guilt. I mean, I have to live with this every single day. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's on my name now, right? So that all being said, as far as what is an SO or what is a sex offender, it's a normal person who did a really stupid thing, right? Are there predators out there? Absolutely. And yes, law enforcement needs to go after those people. They need to stop those people. We need to protect the kids 100%. But there is also such a thing as overprotection, right? And you're ruining people's lives and putting them in positions where it's more likely that they will reoffend because they have no hope, right? And that's, it just seems unwise to me. Now, granted, that's my opinion, but.
Well, and I think I should clarify here. So you basically said this is the first time you've ever shared this openly on a forum like this.
Yeah.
And part of that's because the stigma that this carries could impact you.
100%.
The courage that you had just to say that, I commend you. And I'm honored that you would share it with the group here. So I just want you to know that I recognize what you just did.
Thank you.
And so that shows that there is healing, remorse, all the kind of stuff. And of course, once you get in and learn more about his story, they'll see it even more. I think it's important because you want to share. I think it's important. It sets the background for the rest of the kind of the questions that we're going to ask. So
yeah, and it does. And I mean, I was 19 when that happened, right? I was a stupid kid. But the interesting thing is the trajectory that my life took after that, right? And that, I think that sets the stage for your questions.
All right, so give us a little bit of background on your current family situation.
Sure. So I am currently married to the best woman in the world, and I have three awesome kids plus a bonus kid. So the bonus kid is her name is Devin, and she lives in Kansas. She was a child from my wife's first husband's I'm not sure if it was an affair or something like that, but Devin was the awesome result of that. And they are 23, 22, 21, and 15. Yeah. So I am blessed with an awesome family. Two of my kids currently serve active duty in the military. And then one of them my youngest wants to be a helicopter pilot in the U.S. Army. So we're really looking forward to that.
So if your kids were around this table, give me one thing they would rip on you about.
So they wouldn't, because they'd be on their phones.
There you go.
So yeah, what would they rip
what
on?
What does dad do that's like, they're going to pick on?
Oh man, wow, that's a great question. Farts in public. That's probably the big one.
Okay, there you go.
That's probably it. That's probably the one.
Well, if that's as bad as it gets, I think you're okay.
Yeah. And then, just randomly shouting things at strangers. That's definitely something that, we dance a lot in public. Me and
you
my
dance
wife.
Up in public.
We dance a lot in public. So she is, loves dancing, absolutely adores it. And she,
this is your wife?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, we will spin each other at any given moment in a, Disney line. It doesn't matter. Like, we'll just do it.
Well, for another podcast, at some point, it'd be fun to hear how you met your wife.
That's another podcast.
That's another story.
It's hysterical.
Now comes the fun stuff, because there's redemption and there's beauty in the ashes of all this. So how would you best describe who you are in the context of where you're at in your life journey?
I would say that right now I am gainfully seeking all the time, right? I love learning. I love people. I love being around people. And I've not only made that my life's work, I've also made that God's work, right? And God has made that his work for me. And I am constantly seeking new things and new opportunities, new people, just new experiences, right? Going deeper with God. And I mean, that's a whole diatribe in itself, right? But so we'll stay away from that for the moment. But
so what are some of the things you're finding right now or seeking right now?
Self-respect is one of them. I have found that, with this whole thing, you kind of get labeled, right? And not kind of, you absolutely get labeled.
Do.
And you know, Ping was actually on your show a little bit ago, and I love his bit, man. That was fun. I can't wait to meet him. He puts it really well when he says, you know, they tell you who you're going to be, not just while you're there, but when you leave. And that's 1,000% true for everybody on the registry. So I think that that builds in this idea of who you are, what you can do, the limits that you have posed on you, and that kind of thing. And just to be in a room on a podcast with someone as successful yourself, meeting Tim, you know, those just in this room is, you know, far be goes anything that anybody would have thought that I would have done, right? And that God would have allowed me to do. And, you know, getting to start businesses and bless people and just really everything I've gotten to be a part of is really awe-inspiring and just, I mean, very humbling, to be honest. But what am I finding is that God doesn't care. He doesn't make junk, right? He doesn't care who you are, where you come from. He cares whose you are and where you're going. And I just find that that is so true more and more and more and more every day, every single day. And to watch things unfold in front of me that I'm just like, man, there was no way 2 years ago you could have told me that I am where I am. You know, no way.
How would you best, or how would you describe how you're trying to change the world? I mean, you have a ton to offer. I mean, from a business standpoint, from a ministry standpoint. Sure. So how are you trying to change the world?
Reckless love, man. Reckless love. I don't do a lot of things well. I do a lot of things okay. I don't do a lot of things well. I think the one thing that God has gifted me with that I do exceptionally well is I love people. Love them. Love them. I don't care where you come from. I don't care what you've done, right? I have a long, dark history. And frankly, I just don't care. So it puts me in a very unique position to be able to love people absolutely recklessly, even when they screw me over, even when they burn the ministry, when they hurt us. I mean, it still just allows me to love them because I know it's coming from a place of brokenness, not a place of hate. How am I trying to change the world? I'm trying to spread that because everywhere you look right now is chaos and hatred and just anger and fear everywhere. And the thing that's going to pierce through that is just loving people. You know, you do it with your prison ministry. I do it with my ministry, my other businesses, you know, being able to go and be an angel investor to people and give them a shot at a life. I mean, that they've just seen the hope in their eyes pop open, you know, and just love them through that weird, curious period of like, oh, is this going to work? I don't know. You know, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
So let's have a discussion about Identity Ministry.
Okay.
What is it? When did it start? Why'd you start it?
Sure. So at this time I don't remember what companies I owned at that time, but I know I owned a solar business. And I owned a consulting business that obviously same thing, TENS units, all that kind of stuff. Right. So I go to so I'm also Zig Ziglar Legacy Trainer certified. So I'm at this conference for the trainers and they are talking all about legacy. Like, what are you going to leave behind? What are you going to do? What's your life going to mean? What's your influence going to be? And so I'd never really thought about that before, right? I'm a criminal, so I'm living in the moment. You know what I mean? I can go back at any time, living in the moment, you know? And, so by this time I was saved. So I was like, okay. So I go up into my hotel room and I get on my knees and I'm like, okay, Lord, what do you want? I mean, I don't care what I want. You know what I mean? I got what I want, but what do you want? And, so he goes, you know, this thing that you've been kind of running from your whole life. And I says, yeah. And he goes, well, you're going to go to them and you're going to make sure that they don't have to do it alone. And that was my answer. And literally over the next 24 hours, I mean, God just unfolded this awesome semi not finished blueprint of what we were going to do. Gave me the name while I was jamming out to Greatest Showman soundtrack in my car, which if you've never listened to that straight through, it is one of the best albums ever made. So yeah, for inspiration, for those of us who don't know, listen to the Greatest Showman soundtrack. But yeah, so he gives me the name Identity Ministries, which also is I Am, which I find kind of interesting, but gives me this really cool outline of like, okay, we're going to do housing. We're going to do employment. We're going to do everything that I didn't have, right? Food, clothing, you know, interview assistance, employment, but also curriculum and classes to really get them started in life. So now everything we do in the ministry, I personally did in my own journey, right? And I just give it to the guys in class form.
Walk us through a typical, I'm a sex offender. I get released today. What's my story? What am I up against?
Man, Jeff, that's a lot. Okay. Okay. So typically speaking, if you're being released, you have a caseworker while you're in, let's date back a little bit. You have a caseworker while you're inside, that's trying to find you a place to live. Now you can't go live at, 99% of drug sober living facilities because you're an SO, right? You can't go live in an old folks home because you're an SO. You can't live at 99% of halfway houses because you're an SO. Also, you can't live, generally speaking, in your own house because you're an SO and you have to live 1,000 feet from a school, 1,000 feet from a park, 1,000 feet. If you're on CRD, 1,000 feet from a school bus stop, 1,000 feet from a daycare, 1,000 feet from an in-home daycare, or any church that has a daycare. All of that. Okay, so generally speaking, what happens, and I don't know the statistics on this, I can get them because they change all the time, but so generally speaking, what happens is you're going to be released, you're going to be given $10 in a tent, or $50 in a tent now if you're in Orange County.
Literally a tent.
Yes, a tent.
I would get a tent.
Yep.
Okay.
And they would say, okay, so this patch of woods is where you're going to go live, so good luck. Make sure you get to your probation officer's office tomorrow by X time and let them know where you are.
Okay. So in theory, I've got this little spot in the woods and that, do I have to go to the parole officer? Does the parole officer come to me?
No, you'll have to go.
So I got to figure out how to go someplace. Do I have an ID? Do I have any money?
No.
And then I've got an ankle brace, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah, yeah. You've got the GPS monitor on, which is now new Florida law. So you've got the GPS monitor on. And by the way, if you're not at your designated area by a certain time, you violate. You also have a GPS tracking box that goes on your hip in addition to the ankle monitor. And if those two are ever separated for any length of time, you violate. And violate, for those of us who don't know, means you're violating probation, which means you go back to either prison or jail. So
no questions asked?
No. Probation officer is basically, for lack of a better term, your god at this point, right? They have complete discretion on what they're going to do.
So what if the battery goes dead?
That's the thing. So if you ever notice, and I'm not going to use a brand name here. If you ever notice at a gas station, right, that there are people just kind of sitting at tables hooked up to chargers and you can't see where those chargers are. There's no phones on the table. It's guys charging their boxes, right? Especially here in downtown Orlando. So that's part of it, right? And then you also have to go to the sheriff's office, by the way, to make sure you go and register. So you have to do that. You have to go to probation if you're on probation. And then, you know, you've got to figure out how to get a job. You've got to figure out how to get food, which, by the way, our city does really well with food. There's a lot of really great food banks and really great food programs. So, you know, the guys out there, a lot of them go without meals. I don't know of any of them that have starved, right? So Orlando is a city and the ministries that are here, you know, there's a lot of them I could shout out right now, but they do a pretty good job as far as food is concerned for these guys.
Is my family, I'm asking generally, is my family behind me at this point or have they left me?
That's 50-50.
50-50.
It's 50-50. So yeah, that's really 50-50. So some families are great. Right? Still supportive. Hey, you're going to get out. We're going to help you. We'll get you set up with clothes. And a lot of the guys in the ministry have really supportive families. And then the other half don't, right? The family is spurned. You're the black sheep now. You know, we cut you out of the will, those kind of things. And can't believe that you did this and you're a horrible person and we can't be around you. So it's really just 50-50.
Okay. So now in comes Identity Ministry. Take me as an example. I get out tomorrow. I'm coming to you. Somehow I found out about you.
Sure.
What does my experience look like with you?
Well, I hope really positive.
All right.
That's the goal, right? So here's how this works. So somebody would be released. So you get released from basically a holding cell. And upon release, we will actually come pick you up. Either myself, my director, Michael Miles, there's a couple other guys, but we'll come pick you up. As soon as we pick you up, we'll bring you to the sheriff's office. And generally speaking, we know most of the POs. We have a really good relationship with them. They're very understanding. So either we bring them directly to them, or if it's late at night, we'll bring them the next day. We get you set up. The really cool first thing that I love doing is we give you your first meal. So, and it's your choice. Right. So, I mean, we have a budget, but it's a high budget. So if guys, which is funny because everybody goes for pizza. I don't get it. Yeah,
so pizza's the number one.
It's weird, man. I'm like, steak, lobster, do what you want. I don't care. And they're like, nope, Domino's or Pizza Hut or whatever. Like that is the number one thing that people get. It's weird. That and chicken. Okay. Chicken wings. That's a big one. But yeah, so they get out, we pick them up. Usually the next day we'll take you around to Walmart, Goodwill, get you clothed, hygiene, you know, get you out of the jail clothes so we can get away from at least that part of the physical identity and get you into normal people clothes. We'll have you filling out applications a lot of the day. You'll go to probation at that time. Again, if you weren't able to go to the sheriff the day before, we'll do that first day. And then we really just kind of introduce you to everybody. The nice thing is you sleep in a bed your first night at Identity, right? Everybody that comes there, you sleep in a bed your first night. And it's not a cheap prison cot, what you're used to at this point, right? We have 6-inch memory foam mattresses that I buy personally from Mattress Hub. That's or Mattress Firm. I can't remember which one, but that's what we use in the ministry. So it's not, you know, paper mattresses.
And then how long in theory would I be a part of Identity Ministry?
So that is very much up to the guys. So, I mean, not so surprisingly, I guess we have a lot of guys that just don't want to leave, right? So they stick around. But generally speaking, the program is designed to last 9 to 12 months. So at the end of that time, you should have enough money and savings for a house, a vehicle. You should be well-educated in finances and budgeting and just basic life skills. You'll also have been meeting with a mental health counselor. And for those of us wondering, it's not just for the SO part. It's the guys and girls that we use in the ministry are phenomenal counselors. They get into, you know, history and background and cognitive behavioral therapy and things like that. Like, why do you do what you do and how you tick? And they really, really help the guys kind of just get over the trauma that they've been through being in prison and now kind of reacclimate into life.
And then from a spiritual component, how do you weave that in?
Sure. So, well, everything is a spiritual component. Prayed before every meal. We also have a Bible study mandatory from Monday to Friday at 5:30 in the morning, just because of their work schedules. It's kind of dawned at that time, right? So they have a half hour every morning that they do a Bible study, a devotion, presence time with God, whatever kind of they're in their journey. And then, you know, church every Sunday. And then we also do, we hook them up with classes within our home church at Discovery Church. And then, yeah, we basically pray with them, walk them through, and then spiritual counsel them the entire time they're there.
Do the guys get mentors?
Yeah, we're working on that.
Okay.
So I'm basically everybody's mentor at this point. Do we want them to have mentors? Yes, absolutely. I want them to have mentors.
Sure. Right.
You know, 16 mentees is a lot to take.
Right.
So, but other than that, yes, we're working right now with one of our volunteers. He's going to be heading up our mentoring, and we should have each guy assigned a mentor here soon.
And you also work full-time, right?
I do.
So you are a busy guy.
I can be. Yeah.
Well, I will say I've had the pleasure of meeting the guys at Identity Ministry a couple times now. And it's always, I think I go there to minister, but I always get ministered in the time that I'm there. So in fact, I didn't get whooped.
I did lose
in cornhole, and I'm not going to, I guarantee you, I will go back and I will win. It'll happen.
I don't know, man. They can play.
No.
can play.
There was Levi was, well, he was tough.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to, given the context of this discussion and our listeners, I want to ask you some typical questions that I ask everybody. And that would be, the first one is, when did you realize the power of capital, and what does that mean to you?
I love this question. Actually, I've like I said, I've listened to a couple episodes before I got here, okay. So I'm already and rearing. The interesting thing about the power of capital is it's twofold, right? So I was a part of the car industry where you watch the evils of capital, and that's where I donned my drug habit and all those kind of things, right? Back when I was living that life, and everything was money. Everything. It was like watching Billions, right? The movie, the show Billions. I mean, everything is money. How much have you made for me? How much have you made for me today? That's still not enough. When's your next appointment? You know, those kind of things. Everything revolved around money. And so as a young salesperson, I was taught that sales is the best industry in the world because you know exactly how much you're worth every day. and I carried that with me for years and years and years, man, right? I actually taught people that when I was still young. And so I've seen the evils that money can do. But then on the flip side, now kind of learning about different things. And as I've grown in my Christian walk, and I've watched people dispense capital for positive gains, right? When they don't necessarily have a dog in the fight. For instance, just people not just giving money to charity, but really giving money to an impact or a direction that they want to go, right? That they want to see the world take. And that has been unbelievably eye-opening because, you know, tithe your 10%, right? I've done that since I first got saved back in 08. And that's what I always thought Christian giving was you just tithe your 10%. And it was like, no, you can actually develop different sects, even within your church, to full fruition using and dispensing your own capital. And I mean, the power of capital is unlimited, right? It's whatever limit God puts on it. But other than that, it's completely unlimited, the different amount of change that you can see. And everybody has their own thing, right? You can feed a million starving kids for, what is it, like $100,000. You can, help dispensed families. And if you're me, you can help guys getting out of prison. I mean, you can do a lot of things with capital. So when I realized it first was the car business, when I realized it second, I think, was probably when I got to Discovery Church. And I started seeing people actually following what they were giving to. And that changed a lot for me.
Yeah. One of the notions that I'm excited to see continue to grow, whether it's the faith community or not, is, and I don't mean to offend anybody here, but I think there's this general feeling like giving to a charity is holy, but somehow making an investment is not. Yet the truth is a great investment in line with that other charity could be just as holy, even though there's a return associated with it, and can have even bigger impact. That's not to say that charity isn't needed, because it absolutely is.
100%. Yeah.
But it's fun to watch people when they say, wait a second, not only is there charitable capital, but there's my investment capital, which can also have a massive impact on people's lives, and hopefully in a sustainable model.
Right. And I think there's a place for charitable giving.
Absolutely.
Right? There's absolutely a place for donations and charitable giving. And there's a lot of foundations and really solid, solid foundations that do amazing work that live on charitable donations. But I think that especially in this time in history, not to mention the country that we live in, for nonprofits to really get up and start paying attention to, it doesn't all have to be charitable. If we can create a revenue stream somehow using our nonprofit to build the same mission that we're building, but also, I mean, quantify a return, that's huge. That's huge. And that's one of the things that we went into Identity with the idea of. We're not there today, but I mean, we could be. That being said, I mean, we are, as from the people that I've met in this area, we're one of the only ministries that's self-sustainable, right? We don't necessarily need donation capital. However, to grow the ministry, simply to house more men and help guys get off the road, right? And get them back onto the road to life, we could use said capital, but also pay our investors a return, which is, there's nothing unholy about that. That's awesome, right? That's godly, in my opinion. Like, if you can take good capital, turn it around, pay a return, but also be impacting in the meantime, like, why would you not do that? Right? I would take that over blue chip any day. Any day.
Well, full transparency, Kaylin and I are talking, and we've been talking for a while. One of the needs is for more real estate, more housing.
Right.
And so we're talking about coming in as an impact investor to own a large piece of property that you could put, in theory, 80 of your guys on there versus being spread across multiple houses and all the logistical stuff. The irony is you're paying rent on those houses anyways.
Yeah.
And so why not do it in one community with a like-minded investor who hopefully you can create win-wins together. So we actually have an LOI out on a piece of property. So we will see what happens there. And if it's not that, we'll figure it out. But ultimately, for you to grow and to do this in 8 other counties in Florida, and then to go to Texas, and then go to Tennessee, you need capital to do that.
Exactly.
And if it's investment capital in the right setting, it absolutely helps you accomplish your mission.
Right. And I think a lot of things can be done that way, right? I don't think it's just this. Now granted, feeding starving children in Africa, I don't know how to do that without donation capital.
Yep.
But I think that the mission of a lot of nonprofits, if they try to, and this is just from people I've talked to, by the way, this is my own personal opinion. So please, if this isn't you as a nonprofit, like don't take this to heart. But I think if a lot of nonprofits operated and learned from the business sector and didn't go into it, at least with the idea that we're going to operate 100% on donation capital, I think they would be a lot more successful. I really do. I think they would do much better. You'd be able to attract a completely different audience. Not to mention how great that is for the audience, right? Get to go and be around. Because look, it's real easy to stroke a check. It's a lot different to go and feed the hungry yourself. The blessing that you get, and aside from just the blessing, the different paradigm or perspective that you would get going and being a part of what you're investing in is life-changing. It's absolutely life-changing to realize that the world doesn't revolve around you, right? And it's great that you're stroking a check to make yourself feel good for 10 seconds. But if you go and involve yourself in that, it's completely life-altering because you take yourself off your pedestal, you put yourself in the real world, and you see what other people are going through. But you get all of the blessings of that. You realize, A, that you don't need a Ferrari. No offense to Ferrari. I love your cars. But you don't need all of this excess, right? You just need what you need. And then the rest can be donated or given away or invested in other huge impact missions. And that, man, that what's the dream for your life? That's it right there. Like that would be awesome.
Identity Ministry, if I were to come out, I'm involved in your program, I am paying to be there, right?
Yep.
Because you've gotten me a job.
Yep.
And I'm working. So what if I had some of your guys in here and say, man, why should you be paying to live where you live? What answers would you get?
You should totally do that. But that would be epic. But and so why are they paying to be there?
Yeah. I mean, because I could see some people saying, oh, you just take advantage of these people.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that one. And just to say, newer guys absolutely will say that to you.
Okay.
100%. And, yep. And not all of them, right? Some of them, like you've met Eric, yep. They will absolutely be on board with. They're like, this is cheap. It's easy. What I did when we looked at the program fees, I mean, we did look at what the bills were going to be, but that wasn't really the big designator. What we looked at was what would it cost these guys to live in Orlando in an apartment?
Mm-hmm.
And then we basically drew back from there, mm-hmm. right? So generally speaking, a one bedroom apartment in Orlando, if you can find it for $1,000, I would say you're lucky,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, I have three kids, you know, my oldest son, went and tried to find an apartment or a house for him and his girlfriend and his dog. And it was, you know, finding anything for less than $1,600 was next to impossible. $600 a month, we thought was pretty daggone fair. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, we have all the relationships with the employers, the food, the clothing. And by the way, it cost me $250 minimum to intake every single guy. So if they're there for a day and they leave, I'm still out $250, right? And the guys don't pay until they start earning at a job. So I've held guys for 3, 4, 5 weeks that couldn't get on an employer and we've paid for them, right? So there's always losses that you're going to take and that's okay. But we thought 150 was very fair. And I think if you get 90% of the guys in here that are in the program now, they would tell you the same thing. Right? Do they think that it's fun? Because we have a running joke for all our senior guys, my staff, and they're like, oh, everybody thinks that Kalen's out there balling out of control, you know, off 150 a week. They have no idea that I donate most of my money back into the ministry.
Right.
But yeah, so I think they would tell you the same thing, you know, that 150 is more than fair. It does keep the lights on. It keeps the doors open. Anytime something breaks, which we're probably going to need a new fridge now. So anytime something breaks, we have enough in reserve that it's not biting our fingernails, wondering what's going to happen when rent comes due on the first.
From a practical standpoint, you're building real life skills because 9 months, 12 months from now, when they're on their own, they're going to have to pay bills. I would actually argue it sure feels like the way you're doing it is you're teaching them how to fish.
Yeah.
And, while I know for some people it feels like, maybe you're taking advantage. It's like, no, all these guys want to stand on their own feet.
That is 100% true. 100% true.
And so you've almost got them on training wheels. And so that when they get out, they'll be in a much better spot. So anyways, I commend you on the model, and I love the way that, look, there's tension. There's tension, but you seem to be answering it. If they don't have a job, we're going to be flexible for a while. And I think when you make these hard and fast rigid rules, that's maybe where you have some challenges. But from an outsider's perspective, what you're doing, it sure seems like the word that comes to mind is it's dignified.
Yeah.
They're not a handout. And I've actually talked to some of the guys informally about that. And the ones that I've talked to, they seem grateful to be able to do that.
One of the big things that myself and my staff, we try to kind of always return to is the fact that you're not just paying a fee. You're literally keeping the doors open. So you are now investing, if you will, in the future of not just yourself, but also every guy that comes after you. Because if all of you decided at once just to stop paying, I mean, we've got a little bit of runway, right? But the door's shut. Well, what happens then? Nobody gets help, right? People aren't lining up at the door
right,
to come and help these guys, right? Right. And they know that. And I think that's what makes them unique. And it makes the ministry unique is that they know that there's not a lot of people out there trying to help them, mm-hmm. right? And so everybody that is seen like a superhero. I mean, yourself included, right? You came and met the guys and, you know, you're treated like a superhero. It's very different than the ideology of we're just all looking for a handout, mm-hmm. right? And I think Ping actually talked about that in his episode, mm-hmm. which was great. And that's just so not true. Men want to have identity. We want to be dignified. We want to work for what we have. There's not only a dignity, but also a respect in that. To do that and then have somebody take that away from you is really hard, right? And then to not get that opportunity a second time is even harder. So all identity is doing is giving that back. Now, to those people who would be judgmental and say, hey, you know, I can't believe you're charging them all this money and that kind of stuff. Well, what I'll say is I honestly want to charge them more. I won't because they need to live and they're crippled by fees and probation and GPS fees and court fees and fines and all kinds of stuff. But I almost want to charge them more and then put money aside for when they get out. Mm-hmm. Right. I've had many people talk to me about that. Mm-hmm. That's a possibility. I'm always open to new things. We tried it at first. It was a banking nightmare. My CFO was not thrilled. Mm-hmm. We had all this, accounts payable that had to go back out. And, you know, plus it gets really weird when you're talking about other people's money because we want to make sure that we're doing it God's way. We don't want to do it our way. So that got a little dicey, but we just figured the program fees were fair after that.
These types of questions, how you handle money and what's the right, like, even having the dialogue is refreshing because and I'm a capitalist at heart, but a lot of capitalism goes straight to, it's just all about profit. There's nothing else. And so having these tough discussions about when do you bestow grace? When do you do this and that? I think is the dialogue and the discussion that we need to be in. So Anyways, enough about all that, but I think I commend you for what you're doing. I think on the stewardship side, I think you've already answered. I'm actually answered this for you because I've seen it lived out in your life. Not only are you working hard as an entrepreneur, but I see how you give financially to Identity Ministry. I've seen how you and your wife pour into Identity Ministry, whether it's working with the guys, whether it's having them to your house. And so I would just tell you, unless you want to add to it, you are living a life of stewardship holistically, not only from your capital, but your access, your relationships, loving on the guys. So if you want anything to add anything, but you're living it in my perspective.
I was going to say time, talents, and treasures, man.
Yep.
That's I got to attribute that to Pastor Don Cousins, but time, talents, and treasures, that's what you're supposed to steward. So, I mean, I steward my time. I still am terrible at organization, but I steward my time as best I can. My talent goes very much to my work, but also to potential employers. I'm very good at sales. I'm very good at persuading people and getting them to see the win-win scenarios. So, you know, with potential employers for the ministry, that's what I do. I deploy that. And then treasures, yeah, I give a lot of money to the ministry and then also support our partner ministries, you know, guys that are on the same path. So we've given to Penitent Thief and the food pantry that works with us and obviously our church and different programs there. So yeah, I mean, God's given it to me. He's not giving it to me to spend. Like, I don't need a Ferrari. I like my Camry. It's really good.
I think, did you already answer your question of if you could have one dream come true?
So the truth about that dream, yes, I answered it almost in jest, but the real dream for me, because I thought about this question, this was the one that tripped me up, by the way.
Okay.
Because again, right, it's still that old mentality of like live in the moment. So the dream that I really hope for is that one day when I'm old, and you know, I don't mean 50s, I'm talking 80s, 90s here, if I make it that long, that I will be surrounded by people who got to live their best life and just have come up from, you know, my background through identity, through things like identity, and who just got to embrace life to the fullest. And if I can be around, like I always said, I don't need to own a boat. I want to go have a friend with a boat, right? I don't need to own the mansion, but I want to have, you know, I want to be part of getting the guy that wants it to the mansion, right? Like that's my dream. And being surrounded by a group of people who I got to be at least some small part of that, that's, man, that just makes my, gives me chills. Like that's really what I want in life.
I got one more question for you because I want this to be on record.
Hey now.
If you could pontificate 10 years from now and you could you know make this a stretch goal, what does identity ministry look like in 10 years?
That's it. Money's not an object, right?
Nope.
Whatever we want. Okay. So basically we would identify any state that has a large SO problem, right? Similar to Florida. So generally speaking, Texas, Tennessee, and there's several others, but just a large constricted living situation for SOs and basically having a home base plant there, having employment partners and or entrepreneurship ability for the guys going through said program. So look, not all of them want to work and be in a company, right? A lot of them want to start their own. And I endorse and embrace that as much as humanly possible because it's how I did it. So, you know, having that ability, having that training, 10 years from now, we would like to actually incorporate females. That's something that we can't do now that we want to do. My wife has a huge heart for that because there, surprisingly, there are actual female SOs and they go through the exact same problem. I met one and I won't say her name on here, but I met one and she had a rougher time than I did, like really, really rough go round. And so we would like to be able to incorporate that. That's something that we really want to do, continue to grow, continue to educate, and then eventually maybe get big enough where we can start looking at some of these restrictive laws and start talking to the kind of people that can make some positive change. Like, look, I'm not that guy that's like, I want to get rid of all of them. That's naive and very just an undereducated point of view. But there are better ways to do it. And I think if somebody would just give a platform to somebody to just explain to them how hard it is and how much you're set up to fail, just give them an audience to have some positive change, maybe even offered. That would be phenomenal.
Okay. Well, we know what we're going to be rooting for 10 years. Maybe we'll say 7 years.
Let's go five.
Well, Kalen, thank you for your transparency and honesty and humility. I know it's not the easiest thing to come on and share these things. It's part of how you make a difference and slowly pick away and change these people's perspectives. So, and I appreciate the relationship that we've started and looking forward to what the future may bring and love to own, be a partner and own a bunch of these properties for you at some point. Yeah. Not only for the men and women, but actually I would love for investors all across the United States in theory at some point to be able to put some of their own capital and experience some of this joy and freedom of being able to be a part of this mission. And sure, they can do it from a charitable standpoint, but if they want, they can do it from an investment perspective as well.
Exactly. And if I may, if you are an investor out there listening right now, by all means, contact me. Yes, there is a way to get on board with this thing. But what I'll say is that if you do not currently experience life-altering freedom from your investment, you should really start looking into something like us. Whether your thing is prison or children or whatever your thing is, start looking at ways to invest that capital to really make a difference and make an impact in your world, in your city, in your hometown, I mean, wherever.
I'm going to take this guy on the road with me. Well, thanks so much. And don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. And please rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on the path to a more fulfilling portfolio, as you just described, within the impact investing space. Until next time, I'm Jeff Schaefer.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.